Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and our guest, Carlton Ward Jr., National Geographic photographer. And you're going to get to see some of his photography work in the upcoming issue of National Geographic. I've seen a little sample of it and fantastic. So let's welcome Carlton to the show. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you're a National Geographic photographer. How do you get – there's a lot of people. I mean, I grew up looking at National Geographic. We still, you know, look at it now. How do you get that gig? That's – for a photographer, that's got to be the most coveted.
It's been a journey for me. I mean, I'm 45 years old, and this is actually my first full feature story in the magazine. My path to that has been maybe different from some others. A lot of people go up through the newspaper photography and become world-class photojournalists and then start working for National Geographic. I came from the science and conservation side, and have received several grants from the National Geographic Society, starting with conservation grants, building up towards a storytelling grant, which laid the foundation for me to do this work that now leads to this magazine story.
You know, that's, Carlton, what's really interesting, too, is coming back to your roots. So you've done work, obviously, internationally. You're in Africa doing work. And I hear this from a lot of people, and even in Alabama as well, that they'll travel places and, you know, these places are the hubs of biodiversity. And this, and then they look back home and realize places like Florida or Alabama, places here in the States, have these incredible amounts of biodiversity and are really a place that you can find, you know, this expression of biodiversity here at home. You don't have to travel half, you don't have to be in the Amazon rainforest to find it.
That's exactly true. And it mirrors my journey. I mean, I did start working in places like the Amazon and the Congo rainforest of Central Africa. I had some incredible opportunities early in my career with the Smithsonian. And I learned a tremendous amount about combining photography with science and using it as a conservation tool. But I think also that time away helped me see my home landscape with fresh eyes and really understand the uniqueness, but also the scale of the threat and how fast we were losing it. So that combination of factors kind of pulled me back towards home, and I've been focusing my work here for the past 15 years.
And you're here, work in Florida, and what people are going to see in the new National Geographic are pictures of the Florida panther. So, I mean, Felis concolor, right? But the Florida version of that.
Exactly. And I'm not a panther expert, but I have learned quite a bit about them through this pursuit over the past 5 years. My entree into this was really trying to celebrate wildlife corridors. My first big body of work in Florida was looking at the Florida cattle ranch, because I've had the benefit of having cousins who are full-time cowboys and still some ranch land in our family. So even though I grew up on the suburbs, I've had a foot in the heartland and, I guess, a sensitivity to the issues and that overlooked and forgotten landscape that is so important to Florida today. That's where I began this journey and understanding how fast we were losing ranch lands. You know, agricultural lands in Florida are being converted to subdivisions at a rate of nearly 100,000 acres a year. And it happens to be those same working lands, those farms, ranches, working forest are the fabric that holds together our network of public land so that wide-ranging wildlife like the Florida black bear and the Florida panther can move through it. And so for me, the panther story is a symbol of that vast connected green space that we need for so many different reasons. And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so, you, I mean, you mentioned, you know, these Florida panther, you're talking about the black bear as well, these photogenic megafauna here that people think about, that they do need the space to move. Deer and turkey, you know, can exist in smaller footprints of areas and don't have to have that kind of wide ranging. But the nature of a bear or a panther, right, they got a range. And here we're talking about the state of Florida that is seeing a huge increase. Gosh, it has been for decades, nothing new, but people move into Florida every year.
That's right. If Florida, if we continue business as usual, which is sprawling suburbs, we'll build a subdivision from Tampa to Vero Beach if we're not careful. So the best thing we can do, in my opinion, is invest in land conservation, particularly conservation easements with farmers and ranchers, because there is a list of people out there, hundreds of landowners who want alternatives to development. And if we can help provide that, what it will do is secure a future for agriculture and working lands, and it will also steer the development closer to the existing urban cores. And that's the moment in time where we find ourselves, and the panther helps bring that story into focus, because one male panther needs a home range of up to 200 square miles. So that's like four times the size of the city of Miami for a single panther. Because of that, there are very few public preserves that can support the habitat needs of even one single panther outside of Big Cypress National Preserve, maybe one panther that would be square in the middle of Ocala National Forest. But otherwise, it's the patchwork of the state park, the National Wildlife Refuge, the cattle ranch, the pine forest that all work together to serve those needs. And thankfully, because Florida still has nearly one third of its land in agriculture, we still have an opportunity to hold that wildlife corridor together. And the panther is a great symbol for that. You're asking about the panther, you know, as a subspecies of the puma.
Right, right.
You know, if you look at one, it looks largely the same as what you would call a mountain lion out west or a cougar.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely the same animal. You know, 300 years ago, it was across the entirety of North America and most of South America. What's so interesting about the panther is, as we pushed pumas out, as we hunted them, they were persecuted. As they, as development moved into the eastern United States, the Florida panther in the far southern tip of the peninsula in the Everglades was the last puma to persist east of the Mississippi River. And from a very small number, as few as 20 or 30 in the 1970s, they have staged a comeback. They were so inbred at that time for being so few in number that they were having a lot of genetic defects,
the
holes
old
in
kink,
their hearts.
The old kink tail,
kink
too,
tails.
Right? Yeah, the kink tail.
Exactly. Kink tail, cowlick on the back. But they brought in 8 female Texas cougars, which are geographically the closest other population of pumas. 5 of those were bred into the existing panther population in the 90s. And that infusion of fresh genetic material helped solve some of these inbreeding problems and gave the kind of genetic health that allowed, combined with habitat conservation, allowed the numbers to come up to nearly 200 panthers today.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, what the current count. So we're at 200 today. Is that a pretty solid or just an estimate? I mean, is it done, you know, how many of them are tracked, or how many of them are estimates of range? You know, how many do you have?
That's an estimate. The population in the southern tip, that's an estimate of the adult panthers.
Okay.
Now, you know, a mother could have 3 kittens with her at any given time, 1 in 3, which typically make it to adulthood. But it's a story of numbers. It's also a story of geography. Because the male panther with that big home range, you know, the number one source of mortality on a panther is, number one documented source of mortality is roadkill.
Yeah, the highway.
We lose nearly 30 a year to vehicle strikes.
Now, think about that. I want to stop for a second. I want to stop people thinking about that. In a population of 200, and I've looked at this before, that you're losing 30 a year on the roadway. As a percentage of the population, that is huge. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you look at something that get hit quite regularly, like white-tailed deer, I don't think it's that kind of percent of the population. I mean, it's really tough on cougars.
That's the truth. And it's not quite as tough as it seems on the surface, because the roadkill numbers include subadults. And so, I don't know exactly, but it could be half of those 20 or 30 that are killed each year are kittens.
Okay.
Because it's even harder for them to navigate a roadway. So we're not losing like a full-blown 15% of the adults, but it is still a significant number, and it's actually a morbid indicator of population, because as population numbers go up, you lose more on the roads. But what's really interesting, and it connects us here in Florida to you in Alabama potentially, is the need for that territory. What's happened as Panthers have recovered in the past 3 or 4 decades, you have the available land at the southern tip of Florida relatively saturated with Panther territories. And if you're a young male born, if you're a male born south of Fort Myers, Florida, you're either going to get your butt kicked or killed by a dominant male, or you're going to go north. And so you've had Panthers exploring the Florida Peninsula, going north, going as far north as Georgia. I wouldn't be surprised if one has gone through Alabama here and there. There is one shot by a hunter close to latitude with Atlanta about 10 years ago, and they knew that individual was born in the Okaloocoochee Slough, kind of in the central Everglades area.
That's a long walk right there. If any of y'all that have driven that before, that's a heck of a walk.
And that's, you know, I'm kind of sad the thing got shot, but it's also a hopeful story to me because it says that we still had a wildlife corridor. We still had a path that panther could find its way from southern Florida to Georgia. And that to me is the story I want people to think about. You know, how can we keep the green space connected? We think about building roads to move people around all the time, but we need to maintain green corridors so that wildlife and water can move around as well. And those two things, if you plan them together, can work together. But if you don't, the unintended consequence of our roads, our development, is just turning nature into smaller and smaller fragments. And like you said, you know, an Osceola turkey can pick up and fly from one patch of pine woods to another. But for that panther, for that bear, the number of times they cross a road is just a game of Russian roulette, and it's a matter of time.
We may and not be able to get into full detail on this, but those kind of the pathways, the greenways, I've seen it out west where there's a lot more public land, and they're linking that and ranch lands as well out there with ways to get critters across the road. And even on the ungulate side, putting overpasses because ungulates not wanting to, you know, not wanting to go through a tunnel. What do you think you see for Florida? Is it a like an overpass, or is it this tunneling, you know, some kind of like culvert under the road? What seems to, is there any science out there, any research says what's best?
I'm not fully read up on the science, but I know what they do here, and that's predominantly underpasses.
Okay.
Part of that's a matter of topography. I mean, we don't have the edge of a mountain
that
conveniently lines up to go up over a road. So a lot of the roads, you know, one of the best examples is Interstate 75 or the Tamiami Trail. If you're headed south to Naples and you hang a left and head towards Miami, that road cuts through Big Cypress National Preserve and vast public land. That road has very few road kills of any large animals. And the reason is they've put 8-foot cross fence along the whole thing. And then there are 30 wildlife crossings where the road kind of gradually rises up. These are places where water conveys under the road as well. So it allows water to move, and it gives, and it effectively funnels an animal like a panther to go under the road rather than above it. And once they find that underpass, they tend to use it. I've had cameras monitoring some of these for the magazine story, and they really work quite well. It's a technical solution that is available to make roads permeable to wildlife. But the even bigger issue is making sure you have green space on both sides of the road. Because the Department of Transportation, they're getting pretty good about planning for wildlife underpasses. But if you don't have either public land or private land under conservation easement on both sides of the road, it doesn't make sense to make those crossings. So, you know, I'm a proponent of, let's get the wildlife corridors, the big connected green space, in place, and then you can come back and you can add wildlife crossings when it makes sense, when you have budget, when they're coming to add an extra lane to the road, and it's just an incremental cost to to modify it.
If you're just joining us, talking to Carlton Ward Jr., National Geographic photographer, this upcoming issue, you'll see his photos and talk about the Florida panther. Let's talk about that process here of getting those pictures. You're talking about the number of them that get killed on the road, that is a 200 in the state of Florida. That's a needle in a haystack as you go to pursue this. This is not like, I guess, you're going down to another country and going on a safari tour and taking pictures of the big cats there. These are a secretive critter in Florida. How do you set up to get pictures of them, especially good pictures for a publication like National Geographic?
That's a good question. It's been the biggest challenge of my career. Of all the time I've spent in the Florida woods on these expeditions, mapping wildlife corridors, et cetera, I've only seen a Florida panther for sure twice with my own eyes, and I've only seen it once with a camera in my hand. So to get the photography that was needed for this story, it relied heavily on camera traps. So a lot of people might be familiar with your game camera that you put up on the side of a pine tree. It's a similar approach to that, but what I'm doing is putting a professional digital camera in a waterproof box, adding a number of camera flashes in waterproof cases kind of hidden in the trees, and I'm essentially creating a studio in the woods.
That makes sense to me. Okay, because I'm picturing it. A lot of us run those game cameras. I'm running. I don't even want my wife's listening. I don't want to tell you how many I got out there, but they're not. Yeah, they're not. They're not National Geographic quality photos. So you are setting up your it's Carlton's Olin Mills studio somewhere out in the cypress or the pines.
Exactly. You work with the scientists or the hunters, and you learn the terrain, learn the most likely place for a panther. My camera is one of the challenges that makes it a little tougher than working with your off-the-shelf, Reconyx or Bushnell or Spartan, right, et cetera, is that you have to be very precise about the moment the camera fires, because you're working with optics that only have a defined focus, and you also are working with light sources that have to be fairly specifically focused. So you're literally picking within a foot or two of where that camera takes its pictures. So the trigger systems, instead of a cone of detection, it's an active beam. It's like a two-part invisible infrared laser where as soon as the animal breaks the beam, it triggers the camera, triggers the flashes, takes the picture. And that was a real learning experience for me, because it's one thing to show a panther walking down a trail, but it's another thing to capture the feeling and the essence of the panther living in its unique Florida habitat. So I spent a lot of time looking for that background that portrays the relationship to the landscape, and then a lot of it's just waiting, because they're nocturnal animals predominantly. So the one spot, one of my favorite pictures, is the opening spread in the magazine story. It's a male panther jumping over a washed out section of trail in the swamp, coming right towards the camera. And for that photo, I had a camera, and even though this is in the core of the panther population in South Florida at Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, we'd get a panther coming through on average once a month. It might be coming every 2 months facing the direction of the camera, because you need to have the eyes. And then it might come once a year or twice a year facing the camera with any amount of daylight that can communicate more about the background.
Talk about a needle in a haystack. Wow. Yeah. I mean, so this is a kind of a once a year event, maybe, to get this photo.
Yes. And then you have to have sensitive electronics and cameras and everything operate in a fraction of a second in a swamp that gets 90 inches of rainfall in some years. And there's a lot of frustration and a lot of failure. And that same camera system got drowned by Hurricane Irma. I had other camera systems partially burned in wildfire. I had one stolen by trespassers. I had another one shot by a poacher. So there's been a lot of Yeah, I don't want to tell my wife about how many cameras I've replaced. Just like you don't want to.
Yeah, we'll
like,
keep it quiet.
It's like my buddy's dad used to keep his golf bag next to his gun closet. So when he bought a new gun, he could bring it in the golf bag and put it in the gun closet.
Smart move. I'm gonna use that. Except she knows I don't like golf. That's where. And this photo that y'all are gonna see, this opening spread. I mean, if you could compose it any better, you have tannin stained water, palmettos, cypress, all in the same photo. I mean, the Florida Panther is the star, but the backdrop is. I mean, it says the whole story. So Carl, I mean, you won with that one. For sure.
Thank you. It's sometimes you wonder whether it's worth it, but now that it is helping share this image and share the story of the species with such a wide audience, it feels like it was.
Let's before. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the motivation there is that this is a puma. If you saw one, if you put one of these in Texas or Colorado, you wouldn't really know this difference from those pumas. And the Florida Panther often has a little bit more of a gray color, a little tawny, less reddish and orangish based on the environment, from my opinion. But for me, showing a panther walking down a dirt road on a ranch or in a preserve, that could be Texas, it could be California, it could be Colorado. So we had to find these spots that were in this swamp environment that is the reason the panthers still exist in the eastern United States. Because without its ability to persist in that watery and challenging swamp environment, it would have been wiped out everywhere this side of the Mississippi River. So there's that relationship to that landscape that gave it a chance to come back.
Well, it's you're telling that story quite well here, and I'm looking forward to the new issue of National Geographic on this and reading through this in detail. Also, before we wrap up, too, tell folks where they can get more information. I saw also you're right up my alley talking about the cattle world. You got a book about the Florida cowboys there, and a lot more. People want to. Is there like can they go to a website for you, or where do they look for your work?
Thanks for asking. The Path of the Panther Project, you can learn about that at pathofthepanther.org. And then my work is at carltonward.com. And if for those of you who are on social media, both Carlton Ward and Path of the Panther on Instagram are great places to stay connected with this.
Good stuff. I want you all to see these photographs and make sure we continue this conversation long term with Carlton. Thanks for being on with us today, and best of luck going forward.
Thanks a lot. My hope is that we can save enough of this wildlife corridor and enough of this green space so that, within our lifetimes, there might be a female panther over by Mobile Bay or over in the Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia. Because if there's going to be a puma back in the eastern United States, it's either going to come from the Dakotas and have to cross the Mississippi River, or it's going to come up from Florida. So it's a really interesting time, and it'll be a good test of whether people throughout the East are interested in coexisting with an animal like the panther.
Carlton, great conversation. And personally, I'd rather them come from the South. So we will hopefully have that story down the road. Best of luck, and we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Just like you, it'll migrate from Miami to Alabama.
I love it. That's Carlton Ward Jr., National Geographic photographer. Check out his photographs and story in the upcoming National Geographic magazine.